Meeting will be in order. Today, we will be receiving testimony regarding VA voc rehab and employment contracting practices and integration with the Veterans Employment and Training Service. Before we begin, I want to note that a hire a hero, coming home to work, real lifelines, all have similar goals of placing our wounded veterans in good jobs. While there are differences among these programs, there is no reason that we couldn't adopt perhaps a common title, set of goals, and coordinated management among the departments. For example, the title Real Lifelines has no intuitive connection with hiring disabled veterans. The existence of three similar federal programs is also causing confusion among the wounded and their families. Therefore, I'm asking vets to take the lead and to work with VR&E and DOD and begin the process of blending these programs into a single unified effort with a common title, perhaps Hire a Hero, which you know, really sounds good to me. It's almost a cliche to say that VA's voc rehab and employment program should be the crown jewel in the VA benefits program. Unfortunately, the reality over the past few years is that voc rehab and employment has taken a back seat to other benefit programs and issues. I want to be clear that all of us here share in that shortcoming. The Department and Congress respond to what the veterans organizations and others see as the major programmatic shortfalls. For the past several years, VSOs have been most vocal about the compensation and pension program. As a result, CMP has gotten the lion's share of attention on the Hill and at the VA. That focus has resulted in voc rehab and employment program that underperformed to the point where former VA Secretary Principi felt compelled to establish a task force to review the program's goals and performance and to recommend improvements. The task force reported out over 100 recommendations, including several on contracting. Contract services are vital to the success of the VR&E program as a way to augment permanent VA staff and to increase geographic access to program services. I've asked VA to come here today to discuss how they contract for services, the rates they pay, and how they conduct oversight of their contractors. We're also interested in how VA and the Veterans Employment and Training Service are implementing their most recent memorandum of agreement to improve employment services for disabled veterans in the voc rehab and employment program. It is absolutely vital that these two agencies cooperate in the closest possible manner to achieve higher employment and retention rates among disabled veterans. The recent MOA established several working groups, and I look forward to hearing how this process is evolving. I now recognize our ranking member, Ms. Herseth, for any opening remarks that she may have.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning to you and to all those joining us here at the subcommittee today. I thank you for holding today's hearing to explore such important and timely subjects. Indeed, contract management and interagency communication are key for responsible stewardship of federal resources. And I want to thank the witnesses for being here today and look forward to your insightful testimony. Vocational rehabilitation and employment counseling services are a critical component of any disabled veteran's seamless transition from military service to civilian life. The Department of Veterans Affairs Vocational Rehabilitation Employment Program and the Department of Labor's Veterans Employment and Training Service play the primary and crucial roles in administering such services. Accordingly, Mr. Chairman, I'm very pleased that we're going to be exploring the VR&E program's contracting and management services and processes, as well as the costs for oversight and management of these contract services. I'm also interested in hearing from the witnesses, as you mentioned, about the progress related to the implementation of the recent memorandum of agreement between VR&E and VETS concerning improved coordination and communication between the agencies. The state of South Dakota has National Guard soldiers activated in support of operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. Some of these brave service members have returned injured and are now currently or will in the near future seek vocational rehabilitation employment services. They're like all disabled veterans from around the country who deserve our best efforts to provide that seamless and effective transition from military service to civilian life and to the workforce. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I yield back.
Thank you, Ms. Herseth. Our first panel is an important player in the voc rehab and employment process. DOV has a long history of interest in the program And Mr. Brian Lawrence, the Assistant National Legislative Director, is here today to present DOV's testimony. Brian, you're now recognized.
Thank you, Chairman Bozeman. Good morning, Chairman and Ranking Member Herseth. On behalf of the 1.3 million members of the DAV, I'm pleased to present our views pertaining to the Department of Veterans Affairs, Vocational Rehabilitation and Education Contract Services, and its coordination with the Department of Labor, Veterans Employment and Training Services, or VETS. We thank you for holding today's hearing. The DAV was founded on the principle that our nation's first obligation to veterans is rehabilitation of its wartime disabled. Along with quality health care and adequate compensation, this principle envisions gainful employment as a primary step toward that goal. The VR&E program is responsible for providing services and assistance that will enable disabled veterans to obtain and maintain stable, gainful employment. The importance of its mission is heightened during the War on Terror, when thousands of service members are returning from Afghanistan and Iraq with serious injuries. Primarily, DAV's recommendations regarding contract services and coordination of efforts between VR&E and VETS reflect those made in the 2004 VR&E Task Force report. We are pleased that most of the steps to implement those recommendations have been taken, and we encourage VR&E and VETS to continue their progress in that regard. Though VETS and VR&E are two separate agencies, their concerted efforts are necessary to maximize disabled veterans' opportunities for gainful employment. Coordinating such efforts likely poses some complex challenges. I've been with the DAV for more than a decade, and throughout my tenure, I've witnessed the internal challenges VA faces in trying to coordinate efforts between its benefits administration and its health administration. Since VETS and VR&E are completely separate departments, it's easy to see why maintaining open lines of communications is an even greater challenge. But there are challenges that can be overcome. And among other recommendations to aid in that regard, we recommend that each VR&E office should include at least one DVOP, which is Disabled Veteran Outreach Professional, among its staff. We also recommend that the coordination of efforts between VR&E and VETS must also continue to ensure the establishment of the five-track system of services available to disabled veterans. The five-track system provides an array of services that recognize the variant needs of individual disabled veterans. To be fully effective, the five-track system will require teamwork between the two agencies to ensure that disabled veterans receive appropriately suited services. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That completes my statement, and I'll be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lawrence. You just recommended that a DVOP be assigned to every VR&E office. Has your field staff, have you noticed any resistance to that on the part of the State Employment Services?
No, sir. I think that would probably be welcomed by most of the offices.
Okay. AMVET states for the record that VA does not give priority within the VOC rehab and employment program to those veterans with severe disabilities. Do you agree with that statement?
That hasn't been my experience. There's probably different case scenarios for as many different offices as there are, but I've worked with the Salt Lake Regional Office as a service officer, and also Bay Pines in Florida, and I also am a product of vocational rehabilitation myself, and I worked with the Iowa Department, and in all of the all of my experiences, they've been very helpful and go out of their way to help veterans, regardless of how severely disabled they are.
Should they triage?
Pardon me?
Should they triage?
Should they triage?
Uh-huh. Those applying for the VOC rehab benefits?
I think that every disabled veteran coming before them should receive the same amount of services and attention. Yeah, I imagine probably there should be some level of prioritization that would, I mean, they're going to have to do different things for various veterans, which is part of what the five-track system recognizes from the task force recommendation.
Thank you. Ms. Herseth?
Well, thank you very much for your testimony, and you know, you had addressed some things in both your written statement and the testimony you just provided, but perhaps if you could elaborate, in your opinion, from your perspective and from the organization's perspective, since the completion of the VR&E Task Force report, do you see improvement by the VR&E program with respect to vocational rehabilitation services as well as the communication coordination with the Department of Labor? I mean, you identify that there would be some challenges. Do you see that since last fall when the memorandum was signed that some of those challenges have already been overcome, or at least can you sense whether or not there's a strategic plan in place to address and overcome those challenges?
I spoke with my service staff members prior to coming over here today to get their opinions as well and see if they had had any feedback from the field. And it was thought that there might be a slight improvement in that regard as far as the coordination of efforts between the two agencies, but there weren't really any noteworthy examples to indicate that you know, great leaps and bounds have been made in that regard. I do think that there's been an improvement since the task force report with viewing vocational rehabilitation as an employment program. It used to be just kind of viewed, I think, as an education program, and you know, was thought of, you know, was a different way for people to get through college. And I do think a lot more emphasis has been placed on not only education but employment as well. So we're pleased to see that.
And you would say that that's the case with both agencies?
Yes.
Okay. Are you hearing anything from your membership in particular for those that may live in more rural areas about any difficulties they may be having in accessing vocational rehabilitation services? Is that something that you can assess very well in terms of membership and kind of geographic distinctions?
Yeah, I think that rural veterans probably, in comparison, have maybe slightly better services than what some of the larger centers would have. Maybe it's a little more individualized, and we recommend in the IB that counselors be limited to a certain number of clients. And I think that maybe some of the rural veterans that counselors aren't as busy with, you know, a vast number of clients, or maybe to able to provide a little more individualized attention.
And I guess I just would have one follow-up question along the lines of what the chairman was asking. Would, in your response about feeling that some prioritization would have to occur, do you say that because of your experience and how these programs are just generally administered without funding considerations, or do you say that because of any of the budget constraints that we've been facing within the last couple of years?
No, just
given the increase in the number of veterans that are returning from Iraq and Afghanistan that have suffered some very serious injuries?
No, I in no way was considering budget constraints in saying that there should be a priority. I was merely thinking of the array of needs posed by individual veterans, and that would be the only categorization that we would recommend. You know, obviously, somebody with catastrophic level disabilities is going to require a different focus than somebody with a 20% or a 30% injury to their leg. And that goes along with what I said about the five-track program. That would be the only type of categorization that I would recommend.
Thank you, Mr. Lawrence. I would yield back to the chairman.
Thank you very much for your testimony today, Mr. Lawrence. We appreciate the input and appreciate all that the DAV is doing, your advocacy, and again, like I say, thanks for your testimony.
Thank you, sir.
Let's have the second panel now. We're really pleased to have Ms. Judy Caton, Director of the Vocational Rehab and Employment Service, with us. She is accompanied by Mr. Jerry Braun, her Deputy Director, and Mr. Jan Fry, Deputy Assistant Secretary for Acquisition and Material Management. The Honorable Charles Ciccolella, I've been working on that all morning so that I'll get that right. You're like me, you know, Boozman, Bozeman, whatever.
That's great.
But I know I'm not the first one that struggled a little bit, but it is good to have you here. The Department of Labor's Assistant Secretary for Veterans Employment and Training. And we look forward to getting your view on how we're progressing. Ms. Caden, go ahead and start us if you would. Thank you.
There we go. Mr. Chairman and members of the subcommittee, thank you for inviting me to appear before you today to discuss specific elements of the Department of Veterans Affairs Vocational Rehabilitation and Employment, VRNE, program. In keeping with your request, I will begin by talking about VRNE's contracting process, costs, and management, and then I will discuss our partnering activities with vets. The Vocational Rehabilitation and Employment Program utilizes contractors to supplement and complement the services provided by VRNE staff to veterans participating in each of the VRNE programs. A National Acquisition Strategy, or NAS, was instituted in order to standardize and streamline the acquisition procedures used to certify contractors. The NAS resulted in a list of providers for each regional office for initial vocational assessments and evaluations, case management and rehabilitative services, and employment services. The Office of Inspector General recently conducted an evaluation of the contract and identified several vulnerabilities. And as a result, we've decided not to go forward with the final option year of the NAS, and instead we are in the process of issuing a new NAS for a 5-year period beginning in fiscal year 2007. The vulnerabilities identified by the IG in combination with our past experience will help to ensure that we improve upon the previous NAS contracts. Expenditures under the current NAS average approximately $8.3 million per year. VRNE officers in the field are responsible for management and oversight of the contracting activities of each of their stations. Proposed expenditures are obligated by the VRNE officer, the work performed by the contractors is monitored by counselors, and payments are approved by the VRNE officer. Overall contract expenditures at a given regional office are tracked via corporate management reports, and VRNE officers closely monitor their funds and expenditures to ensure their balance is adequate to provide services throughout the fiscal year. In order to manage contracting activities, each regional office is required to have 2 basic level warranted contracting officers and at least 2 contracting officers' technical representatives, which are called COTARs. Contracting officers are the VRNE officers and their assistants, and these individuals are issued warrants upon successful completion of a mandatory 40-hour training requirement. VRNE counselors serve as COTARs, and the COTARs are responsible for quality assurance, contract monitoring, conducting quality assurance reviews, and serving as a primary point of contact for the contractor. And to date, we have 256 COTARs in the field. We have expanded the VRNE site visit protocol to require a review of contracting activities to ensure the station is adhering to the contracting guidelines for local and NAS contracts. And additionally, the site visit team reviews contract documentation to ensure required justifications for contractor selection are in place. I'll now discuss our interaction with vets. And on October 3, 2005, we signed a revised memorandum of agreement with the goal of improving service delivery to veterans with service-connected disabilities. The new agreement expands and solidifies our cooperation as partners in case management, employment services, reporting, oversight, and monitoring. Joint work groups will develop recommendations to overcome the critical challenges facing the partnership in the areas of performance measures, joint training, and joint data collection, analysis, and reporting. Implementation of the agreement with vets has been made easier with the co-location of 72 Disabled Veterans Outreach Program, or DVOP, specialists at 36 of our VA regional offices and 36 out-based facilities. VRNE's employment coordinators partner with the DVOP specialists and local veterans employment representatives to assess the feasibility of employment services, recommend an appropriate vocational rehabilitation plan, and deliver job readiness training and job placement services. We've included our DOL partners in our national deployment of the five-track employment model, which is an employment-driven service delivery system focusing on presenting employment options early in the rehabilitation planning process. And VRNE staff have presented briefings at many of DOL's conferences, and we've also jointly produced and presented satellite training broadcasts. Also, DOL representatives delivered presentations at our last two VRNE management training conferences. I believe we are making progress in forging an effective partnership with vets, and veterans with service-connected disabilities are benefiting from that progress through the availability and delivery of more comprehensive employment services. Mr. Chairman, this concludes my testimony. I greatly appreciate being here today and look forward to answering any questions you or other members of the subcommittee may have.
We're joined by Mr. Campbell of California. He's our newest member on the committee, and we really appreciate you your willingness to serve on the Veterans Affairs Committee in general. And then, like I say, we're really excited about having you on this subcommittee that is so important. Do you have any comments, sir? Very good. Thank you. The Legion cites that some states where cooperation between DVOPs and leavers and VRE staff, in some states cooperation is good. They also cite Texas and Alabama as states that perhaps have less than satisfactory cooperation and coordination between DVOPs and leavers and VRE staff. I guess I would assume that perhaps those two states, hopefully they are, but maybe we have some other problems, you know, with other states. I guess what we'd like to know is your view is perhaps what are some of the causes and then maybe some of the solutions to that situation.
Well, we've started to look into that. I read that in the testimony. We talk on a regular basis to our offices. We talk on a regular basis with DOL and vets. And in many areas, it's working very well. Sometimes it's just a matter of, is someone available to be in our office? Is the communication always well? But I'd like to explore it some more if we can and report back to you.
Good. Again, I was going to follow up and say that perhaps, you know, that would be very appropriate if you could give us some status, you know, as to what's going on in that area. In your testimony, you mentioned that the IG identified several vulnerabilities in the mm-hmm. current national acquisition strategy. Can you talk to us a little bit more specifically about what the vulnerabilities were, and did the IG find any instances of fraud, waste, or abuse?
Sure. No, there were no instances in that report of fraud, waste, or abuse. It went to the process that was in place for the most part. And they pointed things like that some of the contract specifications, the statements of work, were not as clear and concise as what they should be. inadequate follow-up on our part, on the VR&E part, of internal quality assurance and doing the oversight that's needed and necessary, and in some cases, inadequate justification for selection of higher-priced contractors to perform the work. And what we've done since that report, we have a pretty detailed plan for reacting to each of those instances. We've beefed up to a considerable degree our oversight and the quality assurance. I mentioned in my testimony, we now go out and visit the offices. That's one of the things we're looking at. We're also getting reports on a regular basis on contracting, and we review, in that case of the contract specifications, we review that to make sure they are clear and what they should be, as well as reviewing those price justifications. And it's also because of what the IG found and our own concerns that we are going to recompete the contracts.
I'm an optometrist and eye doctor, so any of you all that are here, if you're having problems with your glasses or your contacts or advice on your cataracts, I can do that after the committee meeting's over. But one of the things that we were governed with were the Stark rules, you know, that prevented self-dealing. Is the VA, are they under those same sort of rules that you can't, are you familiar with the Stark rules that?
I'm not, no.
Okay. Basically, you know, as an eye doctor, you could not do things with Medicare and Medicaid, you know, those two programs, as far as, you know, having your own lab so that, you know, you order tests that, you know, that the government's paying for that is basically your business also. For instance, if you were a psychiatrist and owned a counseling service, then you couldn't refer, you know, to your own counseling service. Does that make sense?
Well, what Dr. Braun was just saying, and I'll let him answer this, was that there is a code of ethics involved with our own counselors and what they can and can't do. But did you want to expand on that?
Mainly to say yes, that we are not necessarily familiar with the acronym or the phrasing that you're using, but the effort to make sure that individuals are not referring to their own practice and things of that sort is an effort of oversight that we do have in place or are working on.
So you mentioned ethics, and sadly, I mean, you know, we had ethics too, but some people aren't ethical, and so in the early 90s, you know, we had to adopt the sad thing is that there's always people out there gaming the system, but I guess, you know, if we're, I'd like to know a little bit more about that, and if we just do have an ethic situation, then I think it's important that we don't have situations, you know, where you self-deal. Mm-hmm. And so I'd like to know a little bit more about what we're doing about that, and then if we do need to address that, maybe some advice.
Sure.
You know, where we specifically say, you know, we're not going to self-deal, and here's the penalty.
Right.
You know, if you do it.
We can develop that for you. I do would say that every time we have a conference, and we do those yearly, we have a fairly detailed session on ethics, and we bring in a guest speaker to talk about that, and then there are certifications that have to come from that. But I'll provide more information for you.
Well, we have and here lately with all the news, we're all having fairly detailed conversations about ethics, and then also the statutes that are in place that, you know, if you go beyond that, that you get yourself in big trouble, which is appropriate. Ms. Herseth?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Caden, thank you for your testimony today and the insights, and I do appreciate your willingness to provide us with status updates on how the relationship is working as you seek to overcome, you know, some of the challenges that were mentioned before between the two agencies. I remember last year a lot of back and forth, and I remember when GAO was here. I mean, we kind of kept the pressure on to get that memorandum signed and in, and I think what's most important for our follow-up, you had mentioned, you know, your department's follow-up as it related to the contracting services and oversight. The subcommittee's follow-up has to be, you know, that we continue to get some information from you, that others have input on how we're overcoming the challenges, what the strategic plans are, if there is one agency or the other that's not being quite as responsive as the other one. Those are things that we need to now follow up with on a fairly regular basis. So I appreciate your willingness to do that. And perhaps Mr. Ciccolella, you'd certainly work with us in that regard as well. And I appreciate the chairman spoke to asking you to further describe the vulnerabilities that the IG report identified. So I appreciate that elaboration on your part. And you had mentioned in terms of the new NAS that you're going to be starting to improve, and not only from the IG report, but your own sense of what needed to happen. You described some of the steps that you're going to take to improve those contract management oversight plans, including the additional site visits, further review, which leads me to the question of whether or not, to your knowledge, VA has ever conducted a study on the costs associated with providing oversight and management of VRE contract services, including staff resources and the training for both areas of the site visits, for the review and elsewhere.
I haven't seen a study like that. We could probably go back and start to break out those costs for you in those different areas, but I haven't seen it laid out that way. So we could do that.
Thank you. And, Mr. Chairman, I would yield back.
Thank you. Mr. Frey, how would you describe VA's overall contracting processes and how many warranted contracting officers does the VA have? How many of those are directly in your chain of command?
The VA has over 700 warranted contracting officers. With regards to this contract, or these contracts, 241 contracts, there was one warranted contracting officer that put 241 contracts in place in a central office. And these were IDIQ contracts, indefinite delivery, indefinite quantity contracts. And then orders are placed against those contracts out in the field. Those orders are placed by warranted contracting officers. They hold warrants that equate to $100,000 or less. And they place orders against these contracts, these 241 contracts, for the services that are needed out in the field.
Does the 40-hour training courses for contracting officers, technical representative, does that include testing? Who supervises the course and the testing?
Is the question to me, Mr. Chairman?
Just whoever knows the answer.
I do not know if these contracting officers take a test. They do receive 40 hours of training, and they're warranted by the head of the contracting activity out in the field. They are not warranted by me because their warrants are $100,000 or less.
You mentioned the number of contracting warranted VR&E and assistant VR&E officers. You know, you have a number, you know, currently. Are you comfortable with the number of folks that you've got?
Well, I can answer for VR&E. I think we're comfortable with the number, but we're looking to maybe shift some of those responsibilities. As FTE becomes available, we would like to have maybe some contract specialists in each of the offices or a combination of offices and let the counselors get back, because these are counselors who are acting in this capacity, and let them get back to working with the veteran on an actual counseling basis and shift some of the responsibility for the management of contracts to a different individual. But right now, I think because we have at least two in each office and a number of others that work as a COTARS, we're okay.
And I guess, who oversees the contracting actions?
Well, basically, it would be the VR&E officer, but there's a contracting specialist in my office that is I have asked to kind of oversee everything going on out there, and then they also work very much with Mr. Fry's organization.
So is that person the national contracting officer? Or?
The national contracting officer is part of that organization. I have a contract specialist on my staff who works very closely with them.
Okay. Very good. Have you got any other things, Ms. Herseth? Have you got any other things? Mr. Campbell, have you got any questions? Okay, just a couple more things, and then we'll get you out of here. What are the range of costs associated with each of the three categories of contract services, and did VA conduct market surveys to determine the should cost prices for each category and region?
We did do market surveys, and we've been updating those as much as possible, especially getting ready for the next generation, the next NAS. I don't know the cost range. Jerry, do you?
I don't. We don't have specific numbers on that right now, but I think we could get it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. In follow-up, can you provide us a copy of the draft of the statement of work now under the departmental review?
It's with your office right now, but I'm sure we can do that. It's been drafted, and it's going through the concurrence process.
Good. Thank you. Well, thank you all very much for your testimony, and I do appreciate your hard work, and I really want to commend VR&E for responding to the Inspector General's findings as a means to maintain the integrity of their program. The function that we're tasked with is oversight, you know, of these things, and then you're tasked with that also. And I guess, you know, we very much want to give you the tools. I've got all the confidence in the world, but we are going to, you know, our duty is to ask the questions and find out what's going on. Your duty is to do the same thing and make sure that it is going right. And then, like I say, we do want to give you the tools that you need to do that function. That's what the American public expects out of us. So we're a little bit concerned about, I think, the larger issue, within VA regarding contract management and things. So probably, you know, we'll come back and do some more things in the not too distant future, specifically concerning that and the contracting programs at VA. We're also a little concerned, or just really want some more information about the VR&E and vet staff at the local levels. And I think what we'd like to do, and you all can perhaps help us maybe in brainstorming, facilitating, if we can get the states together and try and foster a little bit more cooperation, and really would like to hear from VA and vets as to how that might be done. Things like the differences in the education levels, you know, that we're seeing, you know, how that affects things. So again, that's something that we'll, you know, that we'd also like to follow up on. So unless Ms. Herseth has anything else. No, he's just here. Have you got some? Okay, I'm sorry. We almost left you out.
That's my fault.
Good morning, Mr.
It's your turn to speak.
Ms. Chairman, ranking member Harrison.
I thought you were here just to watch and make sure everything was.
Congressman Campbell, thank you very much for the opportunity to appear before the committee and talk about the relationship and the new collaboration between the Department of Veterans Affairs and their Voc Rehab program and the Department of Labor's Vets Employment and Training Service. VR&E and vets have a history of cooperation. We've had previous MOA in the 1990s. We've done a partnership guide. There's been joint training. But with the signing of the memorandum of agreement that Judy and I signed in October, I think it's a dramatic step forward. And I think it's a dramatic step forward because I think we have the commitment of both agencies to bring the resources of both of the agencies together to improve employment outcomes, and not only outcomes, but also improve the quality of employment for the VR&E participants. In other words, employment in the jobs that are going to last, the jobs of the 21st century. And to make that work better, we have to also get the active participation of the state workforce agencies, because America's workforce system, which centers on that one-stop career center, is an integrated delivery system for which business and the employers are the customer. That is something that vets and the Department of Labor brings to the table. Now, with regard to the performance of the VR&E program and the vets cooperation, I think we're doing better. The numbers are up for program year, fiscal year 2005. As part of the MOA, we're also, as Judy mentioned, we're also working on three work groups, the data sharing work group. I think that will be very important. Performance measures for the partnership. I'm very interested in seeing how that will go. And the National Veteran Training Institute training curriculum is a work group, or the subject of a work group. And that will be, I think, if not the most important work group, probably one of the most important. I'd also like to say that the cooperation between the Department of Labor and the VA extends beyond just VR&E and vets. We sit on the Veterans Advisory, VA Advisory Committee on Rehabilitation, their Advisory Committee on Women Veterans, and their Advisory Committee on Homeless Veterans. I personally sit on that committee. We participate in the VRA development of the five-track program. And I think similarly, VA participates on our Transition Assistance Program Steering Committee, and that's an extremely important committee. It's becoming more and more important as more service members come back through the military and transition into civilian life. I think our collaborative efforts will continue to improve and expand. I personally see our mutual goals not only in terms of more successful employment outcomes and increased outcomes for the VR&E clients, but also in working together to significantly improve the smooth transition of our service members from the military, and particularly those who've been injured, wounded, or disabled, and moving them into the workforce. I believe the commitment of both agencies to this goal is absolute. I think that everyone today realizes that no one agency can do this alone, and it's only by working across agency lines that we'll get anything done and we'll improve the better outcomes, or have the better outcomes and the better service. So with that, Mr. Chairman, that concludes my oral statement. I'd be happy to take your questions.
Thank you very much. Ms. Herseth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Ciccolella, and thank you for further elaborating in your testimony the working relationship between the agencies, how it goes beyond VR&E and vets, as you just described. We appreciate that and the commitment of the resources to go beyond, as you mentioned, improving the outcomes to the quality of those employment opportunities. And as we were discussing earlier with Ms. Caden, I mean, in terms of our oversight responsibility, and as you begin to maybe break some of these costs for oversight down, we need to make sure that you have the resources that you need to do precisely what you hope to do with this increased coordination that the MOA requires. In your opinion, since the implementation of the VR&E five-track system at the pilot project sites, has VET seen a corresponding improvement in placing such rehabilitated disabled veterans into employment since the five-track has been implemented?
Well, the five-track, as I understand it, it's still in a demonstration phase. It has not been implemented fully, as I understand. Is that right?
Well, the pilot period is finished. We're rolling it out
this year
to all the offices.
Well, let me put it this way. All of our state directors, of course, we have a state director of veterans employment and training in each one of the states and territories. All of them are very much aware of the importance and the priority we put on the relationship between the voc rehab people in the states and the vets sponsored DVOPs and LVERs. We're requiring every one of our state directors to update their memorandum of agreement, and Judy Caden is requiring the same thing. We've seen an increase for program year 2005 in the number of placements through the employment system, in other words, the active involvement of the disabled veteran outreach program specialists. But I don't know whether it's not too early to tell whether, you know, this is really having an impact. It's going to work where people drop the barriers and work across agency lines and agree that the most important thing is to serve our service members. And there are certain pockets, and you mentioned Texas, Alabama, there are a couple of other states that aren't doing as well as other states. But we're seeing some really, really good ideas and innovative practices in your own state, in South Dakota, for example. And in other states where the program's working very well, and it's working very well because we've got good leadership out there on both sides.
Well, I appreciate that, and I think you answered my second question and perhaps started to allude to addressing my third. The second question was just going to be, in your opinion, how important it is to involve the state workforce agencies in the plans, in the coordination, the discussions regarding that interagency interaction. And so I would assume that, based on what you said, you feel it's very important, in part, to overcome any of those barriers that may still exist by being very inclusive, to talk about what is most important in serving the constituency here to improve those employment results.
That's absolutely correct. You know, we have a workforce system in this country. It's a $14, $15 billion investment every year. There are some great training opportunities in that. Not all the states use all their Workforce Investment Act money. The kind of neat thing about the situation today is that Congress, in its wisdom and I think great foresight, when they passed Public Law 107-288, they established priority of service for veterans. And within that priority of service for all workforce training programs, there are priorities for special disabled, disabled, and then veterans. So I think we're making significant progress there also in terms of attuning and making certain that the workforce system understands that when veterans come in for services, they get priority of services. And I travel a lot, and I talk to an awful lot of people in one-stops, the service delivery people, and I'm seeing a lot of improvement in that regard.
Very good. I would yield back, Mr. Chairman.
Are you getting any resistance from the state employment services regarding DVOP stationed at the VR&E offices?
No, not at all. I don't, we have not had that, and frankly, Mr. Chairman, we've got that written into the solicitation for grant applications, and we do have a hammer, a lever on that, because we've got the grant money. And we've got the state director who is monitoring that.
This is really for both groups. Can you describe the cross-training you're doing and your plans to expand the initiative?
Sorry.
The cross-training, yes, ma'am.
Well, as an example, we've got training going on right now to roll out our five-track system and the DVOP and LVERs and other people from DOL Vets have been part of that training. They're participating in it as we do it in regional areas, and they've also been presenting at that training. And one of the work groups that we've got formed is to develop joint training opportunities working through the NVTI and a curriculum where we both can partake of it. We did a couple of broadcasts as kind of a kickoff of that joint training effort to make sure that the VR&E counselors in the field as well as the vets people in the field got the same message on things like USERRA and priority hiring authorities that are out there. So we're trying to get the message out to both.
I would agree with what Judy has said. It's important for both sides to understand the resources that the other side brings to the table. And it also, frankly, knocks down some barriers when you get these folks out and they realize that they're really focused on the same mission.
One of the things I know that myself and my staff, Ms. Herseth and her staff, are really worried about are these areas of high unemployment. We're blessed. The employment rate overall is down, but we've got these pockets. I'm a member of the NATO Congress, and NATO is a great ally. Those are our great allies. That thing has served the time with doing very, very well. And yet right now they're in the process of becoming a rapid deployment force to respond to the needs, as opposed to the old Cold War, you had all the troops massed to prevent a tank invasion. So they're reinventing themselves. I guess what I'm wondering is do we have the ability, when we hear of a General Motors laying off 5,000 people or 3,000 people, events like that, do we have to wait until we get that somehow reported through the system and then months later it comes out, that we've got a problem there where literally we know there's a problem, from the day that the announcement is made. Is there ability or is there any thinking of how we could maybe respond to those areas quicker than we're doing? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I think you have to respond to it. I believe in the context of, you know, what the workforce system can do, that from my point of view, and specifically with veterans. With the GM layoffs and the Ford layoffs, track that pretty carefully. It's not like 14 or 30,000 people are going to be laid off right away. Like, you know, in Youngstown in Ohio, I think 18,000 people lost their jobs up there and on the steel mills. But it happens over time. So that certainly gives the workforce system a sufficient amount of time to respond. Now, for labor's part, we can surge. For example, in Virginia and North Carolina, when the Pillowtex folks went under and they were bought out, the folks that make the towels and all that, linens, we put a team from the Department of Labor down there in advance of the closings to do training and reskill the workers in both North Carolina and Virginia. And we had a veterans component for that effort, so that we can bring people out of the jobs. And it's not easy to do when people are my age, like in their 50s, to change jobs. But it's just the way things are today, where jobs go away. And we have jobs in this country, 5 million, that we can't fill because we don't have the workers with skills. Then that workforce system needs to be responsive to that. And so that's what we did at Pillowtex. We've done it in a couple of other places. So if the question is, does the system have a capability to respond, you bet it does have that capability to respond and should respond.
I guess what I would like to see, and again, you know, is a very formal, you know, this is what we do in those situations, almost like FEMA, you know, goes in an emergency. Because the situation that we're in now is a little different with our manufacturing and things than it has been in past decades. The problem is, you know, if you lose 5,000 jobs at the local auto plant, then the reality is that transfers to probably 15,000 jobs throughout the system, because there's so many small vendors that are dependent, you know, on servicing that and the whole deal. So again, it's just something that I'd like to see us, and we'll be glad to help any way that we can. But I do think that and I think FEMA is a good example, you know, of just an emergency response that you go in and we would like to see that happen with a strong veterans component as part of that. Would you all agree with that? Or
we'd be happy to respond to that, Mr. Chairman.
Again, something that perhaps we can look at later on. So do you have any, Mr. Campbell, have you got anything you'd like to add? Or?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And one of the things, being the new guy, this may be a silly question, but being the new guy, I probably will do that frequently for at least a little while. But one of the things you said, Mr. Ciccolillo, I believe if I haven't butchered your name too badly, was that one agency cannot do this alone. What are the things, why is that? What are the things that you're collaborating? I'm hearing on a lot of things. What are the things that you can't collaborate on?
Sure. Well, if Congressman, if you use the example of our partnership, the VA brings certain things to the table with regard to the services that they can provide for the service member, the injured service member, disabled service member. They bring case management. They bring counseling. They bring the medical efforts so that the individual stabilized. They bring the program that provides the tuition and the stipend so that the individual can go through the training. Now, VA is not necessarily an employment agency, although they have employment counselors, and some of their participants, a number of them, are placed. And their jobs are lined up by the employment counselors and the employment coordinators, but not all of them. And so we have a system in the country. We've had it since 1944. We had the Veterans Employment Representative in the job centers or the unemployment centers at that time. And in the 1980s, because we had so many veterans from the Vietnam era who were unemployed, that's what created the Disabled Veteran Outreach Program Specialist. So we have two veteran employment representatives in the workforce system, and that DVOP, or Disabled Veteran Outreach Program Specialist, he or she is, his or her job is to focus on veterans with barriers. When you have significant disabilities, such as these, the Chapter 31 clients do, then the DVOP is trained to do a high level of case management as well. And more importantly, that person has access to the services of the workforce system. And that's not only the job counseling and job searches, and the resume writing and the training for an internet or interviewing skills and things like that, but also the entire, all of the resources of the America's workforce system that he or she can bring to bear for that veteran. So the functions, the missions are truly complementary. And if you're not working across agency lines collaboratively, then frankly, some people in this program, the VRE program, will fall through the crack because they'll have to get their own jobs, or they'll go back home and do whatever, or they'll go, you know, back to school or something like that. It'll be a while before they get into employment. And that's real important, especially with young veterans, because young veterans have a tough time making the transition. And if they're disabled or severely wounded or injured, then it's even more difficult. They've got significant barriers to employment. VA can address some of those barriers, and the Labor Department can address some of those. But if we work together, we're going to be a lot more successful.
Okay, thank you.
Do you have anything else, Ms. Sarseth? Very good. I appreciate the testimony, and again, I appreciate the from you, Mr. Ciccolella, and Ms. Caden, and Mr. Braun, and Mr. Fry, I really do appreciate your working together and the spirit that you know that you're trying to get these things done. And certainly, again, that's our mission, is to help you in any way that we can and to move these things forward. So thank you very much for appearing. We appreciate your testimony, and the meeting stands adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.